Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Rana Day of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology has done some work with some graduate students, some research work, about which he recently lectured as part of the Women's Studies Lecture Series. And this involves his study, or their study, I should say, of inmates, female inmates, in prisons in five southern states, including Tennessee. The lecture specifically was about older female inmates, some of whom are serving life sentences, and how they adjust to and or cope with, or in some cases, don't cope with, the conditions that they find there, the deprivation of family contact, their declining health, and other issues. And Dr. Adey is going to talk with us about that here today. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, a few demographics, how you started out, the pool, how many inmates were in this pool, and what sorts of statistics did you keep on them?
We initially started this study about 5 or 6 years ago. We went to the Tennessee Prison for Women and did a small study there. Out of that pilot study, I decided to extend that to other states. One of the things when you're looking at the older female population, frequently in a given state, there's not that many inmates to draw from. So there, you know, a number of states certainly have those kind of capabilities. If you're looking at Texas or Florida, for example, have a lot of those types of inmates. But so we expanded that, and so it was just kind of a state at a time. Of course, wrote, you know, the different states in our kind of the contiguous area to Tennessee, and then we kind of did them one at a time, going to Kentucky and and then of course in Georgia, Mississippi. Initial, you know, request to the state, asking them, proposing what we're going to do, and then you go to they send out usually a letter, or post a letter, in the prison itself, and the women then can volunteer whether they want to participate or not based on the 50 or over age group that we were looking at. So out of that request, we ended up with 327 in those five states. And Georgia has actually three different prisons in Georgia for women, and we visit all three of those.
And these older women that you spoke with, in addition to the stats on their marital status, the degree of education that they have, they told you a lot of rather affecting personal stories of their life behind bars and what it's like, everything from beauty products to getting your picture taken. The little things seem to mean a lot.
Yes, it does. Our interview schedule was really very ambitious, I guess, considering this type of research. Initial questionnaire was 12 pages, you know, covering a variety of different kinds of topics, dealing with mental health issues, anxiety, depression, death anxiety, their relationships with inmates and families, as well as, you know, prison adjustment issues and how they really spend their time, the activities they engage in. And we also conducted some focus groups as well as some personal interviews, and have done, you know, a significant amount of exchanging letters and kind of asking specific kinds of questions in terms of adjustment. So that has really given us some really insights in terms of the voices of these women, in terms of what they encounter on a daily basis. Many of them have been incarcerated for 15 or 20 years or so, and just looking at how they're coping and some of the issues that they have to deal with on a daily basis, the deprivations, and they are very important. These little things, I think, are very important in terms of their satisfaction, of course, and just being able to cope.
Some of the prison problems they mention are not all that surprising. Actually, 88% list being separated from family members, 84% worried about getting sick, 78% wishing they had more privacy or quiet. I think the one thing that surprised me the most was not knowing where you stand with parole. 59% don't know where they stand with the parole board. And I had never heard of that being a problem in the men's prisons. Do they not have access, or are they have more limited access with their own attorneys?
I think that, you know, the issue that you have in terms of sentencing, and certainly a number of states have gone toward what we call truth in sentencing, meaning that if you get 20 years, then you're going to serve, you know, 20 years. And the other, many states now are averaging like 85% of your time. Several states have gone to that, including Georgia. But I think that the question that a lot of the older women have, and I found this also true regarding older men, while they may be eligible for parole and they go before the parole board, they really have no idea, you know, what that parole board's going to say. And going up, of course, before the parole board for the first time or second time, and in some cases they get discouraged, but they really just don't know if they're going to be successful in terms of getting out. Especially a lot of about 40% of the women in this in our sample had, you know, committed murder or manslaughter. So you had, you know, some violent kinds of crimes, oftentimes those intimate kind of crimes against, you know, significant others, family members, and that sort of thing. So I think that's the question that they have. Arkansas, however, is a state that doesn't necessarily assign any years to a sentence. So when a state says life, a lot of times they will say like 20 years to life or 15 years to life, meaning that you would get to go up for parole based on if you did 85% of that 15 years, then you'd be eligible for at least to go up for the parole board. But in Arkansas, it's kind of open-ended. So those women in particular certainly had no idea about kind of where they stood with parole.
A great many of them, according to your research report, having been abused when they were on the outside by a partner, a boyfriend, or a husband, verbal abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. It goes into the highest numbers the closer you get to the very often category, as opposed to pretty often, rarely, or never. I take it you weren't surprised by that.
No, one of our general questions that we had on the initial survey asked that, you know, just looking at their past abuses, because the research does tell us that some, you know, 60 to 80%, depending upon the study, females do indicate they've had some prior abuse as a child or adult, and so we found in our sample initially it was 52%. So what we did is we actually sent an additional questionnaire to them. In a couple of states, we actually included that in the survey to really determine that. And we know one of the things about this research, I think, the information that we were able to gather, that no one has really documented, at least to my knowledge, in terms of publishing this, the extent to which women have been abused prior to incarceration. This is an area that the next step I hope to take eventually would be looking at documenting this, not just among older women, but also women of all ages in prison, really to, we've asked them, you know, has it occurred, but we don't really know to what extent. Other questions that we ask also that's equally important here would be how they, you know, try to resolve this, how, you know, what kind of help they were able to get, how they tried to stop this abuse, and of course, some of the open-ended questions gave us, you know, certainly some very intense kind of information about that process, and really just the extreme kind of violence acts that were committed against these women were certainly, you know, very significant.
The mean age of incarceration you found was 44.2 years, and the vast majority, 41, or rather I should say really a plurality to be accurate, 41.3% were in for murder or manslaughter, very high in the Alabama institutions. 86.9% of the women were in for murder or manslaughter. Did you have a breakdown on in which percentage of cases of murder or manslaughter was that someone taking out their husband or boyfriend or someone else who had physically abused them?
We did look at the at least ask that sort of question with the sample that we followed up on as far as abuse, and a significant number of them did. We don't really have an accurate account regarding if it was a husband or a significant other. I know in some cases it was not. It was a capital murder case on dealing with maybe a drug-related issue or something like that. But I would say the significant number of them, it was, you know, probably the murder of someone that had been abusing them.
Their health status varies, but they all seem to suffer from some sort of infirmity or other. 87.6% report vision problems, 69% wear some sort of corrective eye lenses, 59% have difficulty standing for longer than 15 minutes, and 57.2% have problems walking long distances. How can they perform the jobs that are assigned to them in prison if they have these infirmities?
Of course, if they have limitations, health limitations, then they would not be, you know, assigned to a job. And so that's one of the things that we asked them, or if they were capable of being able to complete a job. Some of them might be given other kinds of tasks or small types of jobs that would permit them to do that if they couldn't be on their feet. You know, so one of the things that, of course, we might, you know, just mentioned, the inmate, both males and females, typically, when you compare that person with the person on the outside, they're typically about 10 years older from a health perspective when you compare the different kind of chronic illnesses and that sort of thing. And so when we're looking at a population of 50 and over in prison population, that would be like a 60-year-old on the outside. So that's one of the, I guess, one of the issues that really comes up time and time again in most prison settings is really the poor health, and especially among women, the poor mental health that they come into prison with, and it's something that, of course, correctional officials have to constantly deal with their chronic illnesses and their really the inability sometimes to negotiate that prison environment, and how can we keep them incarcerated. And a lot of these women, of course, are going to continue to age out in prison and die in prison as they reach to 60, 70, and 80 years of age. And how will prisons be able to cope, and what kind of health care will these people need as they do continue to age in prison?
One of the things that you mentioned in the lecture is that a lot of these women need to be on the lower bunk in their 6x8 cell, or however big it happens to be in whatever institution they're in. And there are really no rules that say you have to cede the lower bunk to the elderly inmate. It's sort of catch as catch can, isn't it?
You know, that's true. A lot of, you know, states don't really have policies based on age. Certainly they may put them closer to the cafeteria for you know, as far as their place they eat and that sort of thing, but in many cases they do not. The women's prison in Tennessee, for example, the women still have to walk, to the commissary to eat, and of course it is, they have to walk a great distance, you know, from often from one building to another. And so that becomes certainly a challenge for this population. And so when you're looking at assigning bunks, some prisons have kind of grouped their inmates together, maybe putting in a separate wing. But if you have bunk beds, someone has to be on top, and so that becomes an issue. And a lot of in many cases, we have found that, you know, some of the inmates have actually fallen and when they were trying to get into their bed and have encountered other injuries because of those falls. And so that's certainly an issue, I think, that states will have to look at in the future in terms of how to accommodate the special needs, especially of those that are considered to be disabled now or handicapped.
What did the older inmates tell you about their ability to get help within the system when they are sick?
The access to health care in prison, sometimes it mirrors what we have on the outside. Of course, we know that most states have gone to managed care. They've contracted out their health care to managed care companies. And so it can be most of them are very frustrated, I think, with the health care system. Some of them actually refuse to use it. Many of them report having to delay getting things like eyeglasses or various kind of checkups dealing with their teeth, and so there's always kind of a delay. Some of them, you know, talk about going when you go to medical. You see a nurse, and then the clinical nurse makes a decision whether you need to get see the doctor or not. And of course, they have to do a copay. That copay ranges from $5 to $8, based on what state you might be in. The other issue that another complaint, of course, is sometimes they will go when they go see a physician. It might be physician A. The next time they go back, physician B will be there, and so physician A may give them certain types of medicines, and then physician B will treat them differently. So there's a lot of inconsistencies, I think, that they encounter as they try to get health care, and of course, many of them complain about that the type of health care professionals that work in the state, you know, in those state prisons, and their understanding of some of the aging issues, and how they're treated, especially if you're looking at how they're treated by staff or by security when they have illnesses. Because in order to go to sick care sometimes, or sick call, or to get emergency medical treatment, you have to in some cases, convince security that you do need to make that trip.
When the prisons are privatized, that is to say owned by private corporations, is there any difference? Do they have their own health care within the company-owned prison, or do they contract that out to a subcontractor?
Most of them are also sending it to managed care units primarily are doing that, and contracting to hospitals, you know, within that area. There's certain hospitals that they contract with if you have to, you know, send someone, you know, to a hospital outside. Most of them provide, some of them will provide dialysis. In some cases, they have to, in some states, inmates be maybe a place where they have to be transported to dialysis, which is very expensive because you're paying for security to take that person from point A to point B and then back. So those are just challenges. A lot, you know, they have, Some states will have post-op, or where they if you have to have surgery, then you come back and you can convalesce in a facility. But, you know, states, you know, don't, you know, provide their own surgery and that sort of thing. And so they're contracting all those things out, as well as the other medical services that we see on the outside, also as states are trying to, of course, save money and curb health care.
Well, they say privatization keeps costs down, or at least advocates of privatization contend that. But the cost of caring for elderly people both in and out of prison is astronomical by comparison, of course, to young, healthy people. So what sort of cost does this bring to bear on the overall prison budget, having a great many elderly people behind bars?
Most experts that look at this, although we don't really have a national average, some states have supplied more information on this in terms of tracking health care costs based on age. But the general rule has been for an elderly inmate, it's about the health care cost, or the cost of keeping someone incarcerated, is about three times that of a younger inmate. So that would be, you know, ranging in, you know, that maybe the 20,000, low 20s, and for keeping an older person incarcerated, that could reach as high as, you know, in the 60s, 60,000. But you don't really know, you know, from really month to month or day to day how much it's really going to cost if someone does have a medical emergency and they're placed in a hospital and they end up in intensive care. It could be thousands and thousands of dollars just to treat that one individual. So as far as planning, you know, the director of medical services doesn't really, they project a budget, but they don't really know, in some, especially some of these acute care cases that might come up. And we know that the healthcare budgets and all the state and federal prisons are just out of control. And of course, they're trying to manage those as best as possible. But it is taking a significant, you know, bite out of the overall correctional budget. And then you don't have room for other kinds of programs.
You mentioned that the number of women in prison has gone up astronomically. 79,003 in state and federal lockups in 2005 alone, I believe, was the number that you mentioned. And some 7,800 of them could be classified as older or elderly. Why so many more women?
Well, women overall are committing, you know, more crimes. We see, you know, if you're looking at gender and crime issues, a lot of women are emulating more of maybe engaging in what, not only in the workplace, but also in terms of crime, as they assume more roles that have been traditionally reserved for males. And so we do see a lot of women incarcerated. You know, part of that reason, I think, is looking at, you know, drugs and other issues that's associated with women's incarceration today, too. And then you have people that have been abused, and that's contributing to some of the problems that lead to incarceration. Actually, the number today is around, in terms of those incarcerated in state and federal prisons, is 111,000. So the women's inmate population increased by 4% this last year. So it is growing significantly, more rapidly than males percentage-wise. But, of course, the male population is overall much larger. So we do anticipate, continue to see this significant increase of women being incarcerated and also as we continue to keep people in prison for a longer period of time, that's also, you know, increasing this overall numbers that we see today. And as women do engage in more violent kinds of crimes and even in, you know, drug types of crimes, as well as robbery and then murder, manslaughter kinds of issues, the kinds of crimes that's going to keep them there. So we're just an issue, I think, that will continue to challenge the criminal justice system as women's in the criminal justice system will continue to increase in terms of their presence.
In terms of cooperation, both from the inmates and from the authorities at the prisons, what sort of access did you have, and what sort of level of cooperation did you get?
The various, you know, the process of getting involved in research, of course, you have to go and with your local IRB board on our campus, and so you get that approval, and then you approach. Each state has an office on research and policy, and you approach them with a letter and a proposal and kind of your questionnaire, and then that goes through a committee that's approved, and then they send that out to the various prisons that you plan on visiting. So the cooperation that we had with all the states was really great. One of the things that the wardens at the women's prisons, for example, realize that they do see an increase in older inmates at their facilities. They do see this as a challenge. They do know that we don't have a lot of information on this population. What are the adjustment issues? What are the problems they're encountering? And so they really welcomed this research. Many of the wardens went with us to the place we're going to be interviewing, whatever that would be, usually the visitor center or somewhere like that, and they would sometimes even speak to the inmates that were brought there and tell them how important it was. So we had really great cooperation with all the prisons that we visited.
With regard to the women themselves, did they interact with your graduate students in how would you characterize it, in a professional way, in a grandmotherly way, in that they were happy to be associated with or connected with young people again? And then what did your graduate students tell you about their interactions with these women?
Typically, in terms of taking, you know, graduate students, of course, some of my graduate students weren't young. Some of them were, you know, in their 40s and 50s that were just, you know, what we call non-traditional kinds of graduate students, although, you know, some of them were of the traditional type. And typically, you know, the role that they played would be to assist in completing the surveys. If they had any questions, sometimes you had inmates that couldn't read, for example, so they did worked one-on-one in terms of those interviews. The graduate students also played a key role in terms of the focus groups by asking questions and that sort of thing, and conducting interviews depending upon the place that we went. Every prison generally required a little different protocol, so you had to kind of go with their game plan because you're visiting their facility in terms of where you're going to be conducting the interviews. For example, in Kentucky, the interviews were brought to us, three at a time. In other states, we would have a whole room full. And so if you go into a room full of 90, like in Mississippi, there wasn't a whole lot of personal contact other than just kind of filtering through that group and then trying to conduct a few focus groups afterwards after some people had completed. Other places, we had more time. So it really depended upon their protocol in terms of how much access. But overall, you know, one of the things that I think that the students learned from this group is that how excited that they were that we had, you know, college students or someone interested in their cause, interested in finding out about their experiences and their life, because they do feel like that they're kind of forgotten. And so this is one of our next project with several of the graduate students. We've been approached by Northeastern University Press. They have a series on aging, crime, and law, on dealing with women's issues, women, crime, and law, I should say. And they were interested in doing a book on aging women. And so that's our next step. And that's one of the things that our subtitle is, looking at this invisible population. And so we just got a lot of warm response, and continue to occasionally get letters from the women, and just saying over and over and over again how much they appreciate our interest.
Will you be doing even more research in this area to go into the book along with what you have already done, or is this study completed?
We probably will, as far as continuing on, this will probably be, we'll base our the book on this particular study. We think we have a good cross-section. So of course, we could continue. That might be something in the future of trying to do something more on a national scale with a random sample. I think the next step would be to try to document more fully the abuse that the women have encountered prior to incarceration of all ages. That's something that we don't have any national data on, and I think that's something that that would be very, very interested, that the Institute of Corrections would be interested in gathering, having that information available.
Which leads into my next question. Why this particular area of study? What do you hope will come out of this? Who do you think will be interested in it? And who do you think will act upon it as a result of the information you've gleaned?
The part of the issue, I guess, in terms of selecting, you know, this topic, I actually was directed toward the women's prison when I was working with the Tennessee Department of Corrections on another project, and they wanted to go and look at the women's prison, and that I became kind of interested because prior to this I'd dealt more with male prisons. So in terms of just looking at this kind of dearth of information, I do think it's as we've certainly increased significantly the number of older inmates, and so I think policymakers hopefully will be able to look at this. I know that the states are interested in trying to begin to think about programming, health promotion activities. If we're going to keep people in prison, and a lot of the inmates that we've talked to and a lot of inmates in this sample across the country are lifers. Many of them are in life without parole, and so this is going to be their home. How do we keep people in prison? How do we do that in a cost-effective way? Are there other options we need to look at? So I think we're beginning to address this issue. My previous book on aging prisoners, which was a subtitle, A Crisis in American Corrections, received a lot of attention from the media, constantly calling and doing stories about this relative to their own states. And so I know that and also have spoken to the National Conference of State Governments, and I know our political leaders that are in Washington from various states realize that we have a significant problem on our hands, as we now have almost 180,000 inmates when you include both men and women. And it's doubling about, you know, every 5 or 6 years. And so that's going to be a tremendous issue in the future as we look at this segment of our society as it ages, as the rest of society does, as we see our baby boomers begin to move into old age.
And we hope that this latest research gets the attention that it deserves as well. Dr. Ronna Day from the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. You can also check us out at mtsunews.com. Click on the podcast, or you can hear us on iTunes.